Welcome back to another episode of Exploring the Arts. My name is Ian McMillan.
And I'm Joel Thiel.
And today we are here with President Merkel and Mrs. Merkel. Welcome.
Thanks.
Hello.
Yeah. Joel, would you like to kick us off today?
So today we are in a very different location
Where are we?
So yes, for our listeners, we're in the Sword and Shovel. And you, Mrs. Merkel, have recently finished designing the new...
Recently spent vibe, too many hours I guess. In here, yes.
So, tell us about that. We'll use that to kick off this interview
about the
here.
Too many hours.
Exactly.
We should give it the name first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You go for it. You talk about that.
Okay, well, so this is this is the Cave of Adullam the idea for it. And first of all, because it does feel a little bit like a cave, because drop ceilings and all of that. But then the Cave of Adullam goes back to the place where David hung out with his band of misfits when they were running from Saul. And it says all the various miscreants gathered to him and hid out. So it was kind of like a Sherwood Forest sort of place. So I feel like that's an apt description of NSA students as they're working on their Latin back here. But then also Cave of Adullam was back in the day, I think one of the media pieces that first really kind of put Moscow on the map was the magazine Credenda Agenda, which was this magazine that came out of here. It was Credenda Agenda and Canon Press were the two kind of literary ministries. And Credenda Agenda was I think back then kind of what Doug's blog is for many people now. It was sort of like their little guilty pleasure that they would read in secret. But there was one column in Credenda Agenda that was called The Cave of Adullam. And The Cave of Adullam was this one page, well, it was a two page spread.
I think it was one, and it was always in the back. You know, just kind of a,
and it was kind of like what's the
Babylon B?
Yeah, the Babylon B is kind of like what Babylon B is now. So it would be little quotes from different things that people had said that were remarkably stupid, but passing for intelligence.
It's probably more like not the B, actually, because it was fake, but it was a lot of satire. That is where some of the first criticisms about tone.
So it'd be something that appeared then with some sort of pithy little response to it.
And so actually I did put them on all of the lampshades on the sconces. I went back through like the old, like from like 1993.
So those are all wallpapered with actual cable.
Yeah. So I went back but each one says what issue it was and what year. So like each one is different.
Okay.
But it's really funny to look at them because they are from like 93, 94, maybe.
Oh, like, wow. Very different characters and issues and whatnot.
Yeah. But, and so some of it's funny to just see what was scandalous back then, where you're like, whoa, that's just. And then other stuff where it's like, it's quite prescient, you know, like.
Yeah.
Like Cave of Adullam was like, usually when people would get their credenda, that was the first place they would turn was to read all the Cave of Adullam. It's kind of like the comics section of the newspaper.
Yeah, definitely.
But then when NSA was first started, the reason it was able to start was because they just put an ad in Credenda Agenda because they had a readership of 20 to 30,000 or so. And so they could just put an ad in there and people came. It was just strange. So that very first year of NSA. Wow. So where is it?
Actually, so the very first ad I found is this little one right there on the wall.
The framed one.
The very first ad and the second ad is
the first and the second
and
ad.
And both of them are well into spring of 1994. And we started classes in August.
They started recruiting around April.
It must have been April. Like, because I think it was like maybe issue number 3 and 4 or something like that. So it had to have been April, really May, somewhere in there.
How are they marketing the college right at the beginning?
That's it.
That's the only thing
that went out. Yeah.
That was the sum total of the marketing was that ad right there.
Various miscreants came to gather with David.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
So the very first year of NSA, the fall of 94, there were 4 students, Becca and 3 others, 3 other guys, and those 3 guys responded to that ad. And the next year, another, how many people were in the next class? Like,
I felt like an embarrassment of riches the second year because it was like 10.
Oh,
wow. You know? That is.
And there were some other girls. That was a big news flash.
So you were the only girl in the freshman class.
I was.
I mean, that's a good segue. So let's talk about, I guess, who you people are. Yeah, so tell us about the start of NSA and how, Dr. Merkel, you got involved in NSA as well.
Well, you do the start. And then
you do the start.
It was funny, actually, because I was a senior in high school. I'd gone all the way through Logos.
Okay.
had been the guinea pig for that. So my dad started that my kindergarten year. And at that point, obviously, I just went off to kindergarten, you know, as one does. I didn't know anything about it. But, you know, when you get to be about to graduate, you're trying to figure out college. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of assumed, after looking at a number of options, I just assumed I'll just go to U of I. Mm-hmm. And so my senior year, I took an ethics class at U of I, which was horrible. And it was, and it actually, the class itself was great, but it was taught by a Christian. He was an elder. Actually, he was one of the early professors at NSA. Hmm. So he was teaching this ethics class, and I was just trying to get like one of my core classes out of the way at U of I. And this is first semester, and it was so bad because the whole room just sat there like lumps, did not engage in anything. He's going through all these different worldviews. We hit Christianity kind of towards the end of the semester. Mm-hmm. And I remember him attempting to explain the Christian worldview to this room. And he drew like a circle on the board and wrote God in the middle. And then like lines coming out, like for a Christian, God is the foundation of everything. Like he's trying to explain that.
Yeah.
One guy raises his hand, which never happened, like very rare. Anyhow, he raised his hand and goes, "Is that what I see on all the food?" And I was just like, "What does it mean?" And the poor professor just kind of, and then we eventually hashed it out. He's thinking of the recycling triangle. I mean, so I was just like, I can't. Like, so bad. And so one night somewhere in there, I remember just crying and being like, please don't make me go to that horrible place. And Dad goes, should we start a college? And I was like, yes. Wow. So it was fun. I was very ready to do it just because I just so didn't want to spend money in 4 years, especially because, I mean, I knew I would be humanities and it just felt like that just would be silly. So anyhow, he decided to get NSA going. And that is why there were no ads until the spring, you know, because it must have been close to Christmas before he decided, let's go for it. So, yeah, somewhere around March or April, they put the ad in, and I was just relieved that three other guys came, you know, so it wasn't just me being homeschooled.
Oh, totally.
So that first year, it was the four of us, and we met in the previous president, Roy Atwood, in his dining room for the first couple weeks. Then we found our own location, which was a apartment over a garage. On Greek Row, actually, up at U of I. So we met in this upstairs of a garage, and that is where I met Ben, because he jumped into our Greek class halfway through.
Yeah, so I was a U of I student, and I had actually got to know Doug through, I had started the U of I lacrosse club, and so I was leading this lacrosse club. Logos had a lacrosse team and Doug was the coach. And so we would practice together frequently. And I got to know Doug through that. I had become Reformed, but I was at a different church. And so I kind of knew Doug and I knew he was Reformed. And then I was actually sympathetic with him on a number of things. And then when I heard about the starting of NSA, I was actually studying chemistry, but I was really getting interested in, I don't know, taking my faith more seriously and and particularly in the intellectual side of the faith. I think becoming Reformed had made me more engaged in thinking through Christianity as something that provided this intellectual rigor. And I really wanted to learn biblical Greek. And so I was going to take Greek at the U of I, but then I heard the NSA was going to offer biblical Greek. So, and then it was going to be Doug teaching it, which I thought would be interesting. So I signed up for that first Greek class. I joined a ways in. I can't remember at what point it was. So I had to, I remember over break having to cram and get caught up on the Greek and then join them. And they were all in that upstairs apartment at that time. So that was actually where we first met, was in that Greek class.
Now, obviously, as the first class, everything was new. Can you talk about like the development of the curriculum while you were
Well, that is actually really funny. If you look at, you should go read that second ad because they kind of laid out, here's first year, second year, third year, fourth year. You'll notice fourth year is very sketchy at that point. because it was like, we've got 3 years before we, before we have to get to that. So it really was, I think the first year they had pretty well pegged out. It was only three classes, was full time when I was doing it. And it was about, I think we were reading a book a week per class. So it was a significant, you know, amount of work. And it was basically all of our classes would be Monday and then recitations were all Friday. And, you know, disputatio was on Friday.
Yeah. Did you guys wear robes then still?
No. Well, okay. Okay.
When there was robes come out?
There was a bad stretch for a minute.
Okay.
Where I know that I had them, but I don't think it was. I think it was a couple of years in.
Okay.
And one of the professor's wives sewed them.
Ooh.
And they were not the black rope. They were like shorter and they were kind of navy blue and they had this sort of maroon velvet trim involved somewhere.
Okay.
So anyway, it's good that we just have the plain black yeah, yeah. academic look now. So yeah, disputatios were
funny. I think
the
robes came along by the second or third year.
Maybe, maybe. And yeah, disputatios were a lot more
chaotic.
It was just a big fight. I mean, it really was a disputatio. Like one person would present. So I like did disputatio, I don't know how many times through my NSA career. Yes, because it was like rotate through. You had to present a paper or something and then everybody would argue. And it was just a very rowdy time. Mm-hmm. And I remember one specific guy who is the reason for the dress code. There are a lot of things I could tell you, but he would like, I remember one time dropping to his knees and like shouting in the middle of this disputatio. Anyway, so that's kind of how things were going back then.
Wonderful.
So,
some
rowdy times.
I guess maybe my next question is like in its founding, was kind of the mission the same or was it kind of just like a continuation of Logos? Like what was kind of the mission of the college at that point and what, I don't know, maybe development of that mission to now?
I think it was never supposed to be like a continuation of Logos in one sense, but the mission was very much the same as it is now. And I think the vision for what is now was always there then, you know, like, but it just takes a while to build something.
Yeah.
And, It was definitely like a great next step after going through Logos. It was Logos was a great prereq for NSA, but it wasn't just sort of like grade 13.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I came on to faculty in, I think it was 99. Someday I'm going to have to sit down and do this math.
Yeah.
Because I think it was around 99 that I started.
Maybe.
I was a TA for Doug's class. I started Greyfriars and I was doing ministerial training. And then Doug taught the freshman theology class, Lordship. And I TA'd 1 year. And then the next year I took over it and I was the
To be clear, it was not while I was a student.
No.
Oh, no.
this was after.
Yeah. I had graduated before he was faculty.
Yeah, we got married in 97 and I started, I think, in 99. So I started doing Greyfriars and then came into that. So I think I was there pretty early on. Chris Schlecht was the first hired employee for NSA. And it was pretty shortly after that we got Peter Leithart and John Schwant. Leithart was doing theology. He had just finished his PhD at Cambridge. And John Schwant was doing languages, Latin and Greek. And then he kind of started really focus on the Greek. And I came in right in that mix. I think I maybe was a little bit before Schwant. But anyhow, so I think I got to see the slow evolution and I don't think there was ever any like shifting of what the vision was, but I do think there's been a consistent refining of, okay, if we want to do that, if we really are serious about that, what do we need to do better at or how do we need to tweak? There would be, you know, I think philosophy used to be taught earlier on and we pushed music to the beginning and philosophy to a little bit later. We found that
I didn't have music. I didn't have music.
Yeah,
that
was
a
thing.
Whole year of philosophy, my junior year maybe. And then they decided that was actually not a good idea and replaced philosophy with music for a while and then reintroduced philosophy later. So
Well, it was when philosophy was dropped, I think that was when we shifted into Traditio, which was this larger sort of integrated course. And then that was broken up back into literature and philosophy. But music was pushed to the beginning with the idea of that was about wanting music, wanting students to be like musically a part of the culture here from the very beginning. And that's had, I think, a pretty profound impact on Moscow. Just this idea that to be a part of this crowd is to be about psalm singing and a more mature understanding of music. Languages used to be 2 years of Latin and then 2 years of Greek. That's what everybody got. And then actually used to be, well, when we did it, it was when I did that one class that first year, it started with Greek and then moved to Latin.
Yeah.
And they switched it, decided that Latin was best first.
Yeah.
And then after doing that for a while, it changed to, well, now we're going to do 3 years of classical language and, you know, the new requirement. So things have shifted around a little bit, but all of it has always been about that mission of graduating leaders who shape culture under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Although that mission statement itself comes along a little bit later as they're trying to distill what is it that they're trying to do. I think they keep getting more specific and a little bit clearer.
And speaking of Latin first, especially for the first year students, I get asked this fairly frequently by my non-NSA friends. Why Latin? Right. Why is that?
Yeah, what's the deal with Latin?
What is the deal with that? Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, first of all, I would say the study of language itself is really critical. I just read an article yesterday about over the last 10 years, the drop in college students taking another language. There's a persistent trend in losing that. But I think studying another language opens your mind up to a different way of thinking. It gives you an ability to sort of step back and look at things that you just presupposed in interesting ways. I think it makes you more precise and it makes you an improved communicator. So I think just studying another language is really important. And I think it's funny for America being so about multiculturalism and diversity that what you're seeing is actually that shrinking of the ability to have a variety of perspectives and to think in a, you know, in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
We actually don't like diversity that much in America. Anyhow, and I think that studying another language is a really good way to have healthy diversity, like to appreciate a different perspective. Like when you read a language, when you start to be able to think from a in a different language, it really makes you rethink how you just things that you just presupposed beforehand. So there's that. So you should be studying other languages. Then, well, what languages? Well, I think Latin is particularly helpful for a couple of reasons. One, I think Latin is more more ordered than most other languages. I think of like I've done you know, biblical Hebrew, German, Anglo-Saxon, and Greek, and of all of those, Latin has the greatest linguistic precision in what's going on. You know, linguistically, it's just very ordered, and you and it forces you to think of language in a much more precise way.
Sure.
I think people who have studied Latin tend to then, when they're speaking in English, be much more precise. Things like when you use who versus whom, it's very difficult when you haven't thought in terms of cases. It's very difficult to explain. But once you've done Latin, all of a sudden it becomes quite obvious. And I think you see that in and students who have Latin in their background, their English is just much better. And the more precise you're able to speak, that actually makes you think more precisely.
Right.
You're more careful. So I think there's that reason. And then the last reason would be because from, you know, about the fourth or fifth century on, Latin has been the language of Christendom. And I think it is important for us to be rooted in that heritage.
Yeah.
It informs who we are, where we come from as people of that faith. And I think we ought to have that deep in our bones. It helps us reconnect to those that went before and laid the foundation that we work on. I think it's really interesting to me, just in my own doctoral work, noticing how much of the Reformation happened in Latin and is still in Latin. Like we actually don't know, you know, 90% of what went on in Latin or went on in the Reformation, because it's actually there in Latin.
Yeah.
And we've forgotten how to access it.
Well, I would say too, like when we were in Oxford, when he was doing his dissertation, there are so many libraries in Oxford, and just one of them was his college library, which was the Christ Church Library. And I remember hanging out once, he was doing something, and I was chatting with a librarian there, And she was telling me that they have in their library like 20,000 volumes that are not even cataloged. They have no idea what's in there. So they had two full-time catalogers working on this thing, but she had pulled out a first edition Copernicus just last week, you know, just as one does.
Yeah.
And it was on display and like but they don't know
that they had it.
Yeah. And I feel like it is a similar thing with all of this stuff from the Reformation that like has never been translated. Nobody even knows what's in it. It's just like, you know, it's like the Christchurch Library, but probably much vaster. Yeah. And it seems
this is so before the work that I did at Oxford, I spent a lot of time on Alfred and Alfred the Great. And he goes through this moment where Anglo-Saxon England has forgotten his heritage and he's trying to launch this new renaissance and revival in Anglo-Saxon England. And so he's encouraging them to recover the ability to read in Latin and he's translating texts from Latin and Anglo-Saxon so that other people can read them. But he's trying to get them to read the text in Latin. And he has this description of how from his youth, his great love is hunting. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, it's like, we're the kind of people who can sit there and see the animal tracks and we've lost the skill of being able to track it. Mm-hmm. Like you're the kind of person who can see an animal track and doesn't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to hunt anymore. Mm-hmm. And it really, for him, came down to recovering the ability to read Latin.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's tacky to pull my phone out, but I'm doing it.
Oh.
I saw this actually just this morning. It was somebody's tweet. Learning a modern language. Where is the train station? I am well, thank you. Here is my pencil case. Learning Latin. Indeed, they desire glory. Have you expelled jealousy from your soul? We must sacrifice before we wage war. Seemed apt.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so I guess maybe from there, and kind of what you were just talking about, we can... I mean, that probably opens a discussion on just classical education broadly. So I guess, you know, like I grew up in a public school kind of context and so NSA was my first exposure to classical education. So could you just give a little maybe elevator pitch or like what is classical Christian education and what's unique about NSA's kind of education there?
Yeah, sure. That's a huge question, but I think it can be answered sort of from two different angles. One is there is a method, which is that most of all, we are working to teach students to think and to communicate and to be able to access certain sort of core skills of the human person and to sharpen those skills. So that's where logic, reason, argumentation, but also writing, speaking, being able to read carefully, being able to be creative. Yeah. Those are these sort of core skills that I think most educational systems have forgotten. Mm-hmm. They've forgotten how to develop them. Because education has become so dominated by vocational certification, how to teach you this one like skill, and then to credential, give you a credential for that skill. So what they're doing though is they're working on the things that are on the surface. Mm-hmm. That are the easiest things to do. And they're ignoring the things that are at the core that are the hardest things to develop.
Sure.
And so when I talk to, like businessmen now who are hiring, they will tell you that, a lot of people are just sick of college and they don't believe that college is giving any value because they get people who have very thin credentialed skills. Mm-hmm. But no sort of core human strength. Mm-hmm. And those thin skills are the things that the workforce themselves could have trained and probably could have done a better job.
Totally.
What they're looking for are people who know how to think, how to be critical, how to write, how to argue, how to persuade, how to listen and actually understand what the person was saying rather than other things that I was thinking about while you were talking.
Yeah.
That's actually really hard to get to. And I think it's what we are focusing on. And that's what the liberal arts were always about imparting. I know from like the number of businesses that I get emails from every week looking for NSA grads to hire. It's like there is such a need for the kind of talents that we're producing.
Totally.
And then the second thing is there's a tradition, there's an inheritance that we're passing along. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that sort of that Latin accessing, you know, who our people are. And I mean that in terms of the inheritance we have in our faith. Right. There's this incredible inheritance that goes with this long intellectual tradition. You could describe it as the great books collection. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit more than that. But the great books is a good way of describing it, where we have this intellectual heritage that we stand on the shoulders of people who stood on shoulders of the people who stood on shoulders. I mean, we are so high up when we stand in this tradition. And what you're seeing in America right now is how quickly that whole heritage can be lost when it's not passed along. Totally. And so I think, you know, a lot of times people will think very pragmatically, like, what pragmatic good is it for you to have studied history or philosophy or those sorts of things? Mm. Well, look at a nation who has an entire generation of youth who can, you know, what was it this last week? They read 2 pages of Osama bin Laden's letter to America, and everybody's mind is blown. And it's like, how were you raised? What have you been reading up till now that just throws you so much? Yeah. And like when you don't have this intellectual heritage, then you have people who are so gullible and easily pushed over by something like that. You think of, you know, the year 2020, where we closed down our economy and are still reaping the rewards of that foolish decision. But we had a whole nation who thought you could do that. And so when you don't study history, when you don't study philosophy, you lose a nation. You don't have a government. You don't have an economy. You don't have all these things that were given to us, but we have flushed because we don't study this and we don't pass it on to the next generation. So I think that is at the heart of what we're trying to we're trying to create a next generation of leaders who are able to pass on what we had.
And probably one of the most important ways of doing that is through parenting. So having met at NSA, how did you bring like the classical education, the principles of classical education into your marriage and your family?
I'll let you start there.
Well, I mean, obviously it's true. Parenting is, a school can only do so much. Mm-hmm. And much of the concrete work is done at home. Mm. As far as our family, I mean, we lived in Moscow, so we put our kids in Logos, which was really fun because it was in many ways the same school I had gone through, and in other ways, night and day better.
Yeah.
Similar to NSA. You know, like my kids are in one way getting the same thing I got, and in another way, it's just like far beyond. But we put our kids in Logos, and then we moved to England when Ben was getting his doctorate. Mm-hmm. So we homeschooled while we were there. And yeah, I was kind of in a panic the whole time that we were. I was like, I don't want to like ruin our kids, you know, education, because we're sacrificing that on the altar of dad's education. So, I think classical education was always very much just a part of this is how we do it.
I would say, like, as a teacher at NSA and as an administrator here, I do see how much we stand on the shoulders of the parents who send their kids here. Like, we're able to do what we do because we get a certain kind of student. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just grab your average crop of kids out of America, plunk them down here at NSA, and think that you could have what we've got. This is the result of a lot of people pulling in the same direction over a long period of time, and we're able to go so much further because of it. But I think it is interesting how it does spill over to the home, because I think one of the things that's really interesting in parenting, and it's proverbial, it's expected in America today, that there's always this generation gap, that parents and children they're in one house, but they're two different cultures.
Yeah.
And it's just expected that they're supposed to not understand one another and probably kind of resent each other. Mm-hmm. And there's this expectation of the rebellion that the kids have to go through as their culture throws off the kind of expectations of their parents. That little dialectical explosion that is expected in all American contemporary culture, when your parents and children are united together in what we're doing, all of a sudden that's gone. I mean there is still obviously youth and age. There is some kind of dialectic that's there. But like, we're listening to the same music, we're reading the same authors, we're having the same heroes, we're despising the same villains. there's a uniformity there that allows you to actually, this goes back again to that, can we pass on to them what we received and they receive it? I think American culture expects the children to not receive, it programs the children to not receive any inheritance being passed on, which leaves them paupers. I mean, it leaves them disinherited and without anything. And when you have multiple generations that are in the same tradition, and I can say, hey, this is valuable, and I hand it on, and they receive it and they improve upon it and then hand it on to their children, that's how you actually create this incredible cultural wealth.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So then you become the president of NSA. Yes.
How did that happen?
Yeah. How did that, where did that come? And then just how has that been?
It's funny. So I became president in 2015. How has it been? It's funny because we've talked about this a lot. I think in a lot of ways, I would say it kind of felt like God was drunk driving with my life up until that moment. Yeah. What I mean by that is when it comes to college, there's always this like, so you're going to pick your major because you know what you want to be. And that's always the question. What is it you want to be? And you're going to pick the name, that major that names what you'll be. I never, ever could have answered that question. What do you want to be? Like, I don't know. It was hard to say. I think I started to get the feeling that I really wanted to go into ministry by the time I was finishing my undergraduate.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be in ministry in one way or another. That's why shortly after graduation, I went into Greyfriars, which was what Becca's dad had started. So I go into Greyfriars and I start wanting to get ready to be a pastor, but that's when I got pulled into teaching at NSA, TAing that lordship class and then becoming the teacher. And what I started to see was that as a teacher, I was actually having a far more profound effect on the lives, the spiritual lives of students than I was in ministry itself. So I found freshman theology to be this, it had such a huge impact on students. And I would get that back all the time. Like, this class was changing my life. And I started to see NSA itself changing the lives of students, where when you go to a public university, we've seen this where Christian parents raise their kids and send them off to a public university, and they come back completely changed and completely hostile and turned against them in all kinds of ways. What I started to see with NSA was the exact opposite, which was it was a profound effect and a profound transformation, but we were actually able to help students understand who they were in Christ, who God was, what he would have them be. Yeah. And all of a sudden we are seeing these kids like really spiritually well-formed. And I found teaching at NSA just to be so rewarding to be able to be a part of that. Yeah. So that's when I decided, I did a master's in English Lit at the U of I, but I decided, okay, I really want to do this and I want to do it well. And I wanted NSA to be in a position where NSA was well credentialed, in that I wanted to bring prestige and integrity to the school, and I didn't want to do it with just a master's in English Lit from the U of I. I wanted to get a degree that would allow me to be a blessing to NSA. And so that's why I applied for Oxford. I got accepted to do a master's in Jewish studies and then stayed on to do the doctorate. And I thought having that would bring something to NSA that would be something really significant. Mm-hmm. But when I came back, in the meantime, you know, my position had been filled, but there really wasn't room for me to come back to NSA.
Yeah.
And so I got the PhD at Oxford and I come back and I ended up as a pastor at Christ Church again.
It's kind of like, you know, when you don't wear your retainer for a while and then you try to put it in and it just doesn't fit anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Oh no, oh no, we went back to Moscow and the retainer doesn't fit.
So I started as a minister at Christ Church. I became the executive pastor at Christ Church. I started preaching. Preaching was going really well. I started to like, okay, I think I'm really good at this. And then I just started thinking, well, maybe the NSA thing, maybe that wasn't what God had for me, you know, which weird that I got a doctorate from Oxford. I mean, we sold our house and everything in order to go to England. But, you know, so there was, it's like, I'm probably about 30, maybe, I was probably about hitting about 40 at this point. And
no, you defended your dissertation right before you turned 40.
Yeah, right. Okay, so
same summer.
I'm about 40 now, and you know, you think at 40 you're gonna know what you want to do with your life. Still, just totally, totally clueless.
Yeah.
I remember. I think this was when we were first married. I was like, I set the goal of I want to have no mortgage by the time I'm 40. You know, no mortgage by the time you're 40. I hit 40. No mortgage because we were just renting. And so nailed it. So I'm executive minister at Christ Church. Then NSA pulled me back in as academic dean. I was director of student affairs. Mm. Then I came in as dean. I was half time. So I'm executive minister at Christ Church and dean at NSA, and starting to kind of rekindle that love for being a part of the institution and what was going on here. The previous president, Dr. Atwood, he stepped down, and when he stepped down, they go into a search for college president. And it was really at that point, it was just really remarkable how, the doctorate from Oxford, the time as dean, all the time teaching NSA, but combined with actually serving, as a pastor. I think most college presidents, at least of Christian colleges, frequently what they do when they travel is they preach, and having a experience in preaching and getting up and speaking like that was really strong. But also at Christ Church, I had been the executive minister, which had meant I had now stepped into managing a budget, managing personnel and all of that. And the institutional leadership was something I had been thinking about for a couple of years. So suddenly when this position opened, it was just like everything clicked. And suddenly you understood
All those threads came together. Yeah.
Why everything was where it was, and it just really clicked. Like, yeah, okay, I get it. I understand. And ever since then, it's just been really clear what we were to do. I think though, 2020 took what happened and then just floored it, because when 2020 hit, we saw everybody. It was, you could see across America, everybody just stepped back. And like, I'm just going to go home and I'm just going to watch Netflix. And everybody lost all of their ambition and stayed home. And you could tell this is the moment. And so everybody kind of went this way and you could see this huge space.
Yeah.
So we floored it and went into that. And since 2020, we have just been going full speed. But it has been remarkable how clear in retrospect all of it was bringing us to where we are right now.
Totally.
Almost as if God knew what he was doing. Almost that whole as time. If.
And I guess on that note, you know, looking to the future of NSA, are there any exciting things you'd like to share with, or any updates to the college? What's anything for the future that you want to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, I think we are in a really significant growth phase. I think that the next steps are starting to get clearer and clearer. I think the year 2030 will be a really big year for us as we start to see our numbers all come together in a certain way. And I think that, you know, we picked up that North Campus building, getting our facilities all the way completed. I think the addition of regional accreditation, or the accreditation that was formerly known as a regional. It's all national now, but we still call it regional. Regional with the accreditation with NWCCU was a big step that will, I think, help graduates quite a lot and moving on to do what they want to do. But I think we're really turning a very significant corner, kind of coming onto the national stage. I know, looking at Logos School, if you look at the stages of Logos School, Logos starts in 81. And when Becca graduates in 94, then you see that generation goes off to college, gets married, have kids. Then all those kids all hit Logos in the early 2000s. And that's when our kids are all showing up at Logos, and all of a sudden there's this big surge. And then there's a second one that hit in 2020, and all of a sudden that thing is really growing. Well, NSA, we're now to the point where we're freshman classes, a bunch of these kids of those early NSA students, and it's starting to grow. And as we sit on the kind of shoulders of the whole classical Christian education movement, as that movement really explodes, now all of a sudden we're seeing this really increased interest in what we're doing, as well as culturally, I think people understand and appreciate more the significance of a college being different. So I would say over the next few years, what you're going to see will be you're going to see a little bit more growth. We've had a lot of growth over the last 4 years. I think we doubled the undergraduate in the last 4 years.
Okay.
Over the next several years, you'll see this next freshman class will be the last time that we'll see another kind of significant bump. Mm-hmm. And after that, I think it's going to be, we're going to be holding the brakes for a little bit and not growing above that. So we'll be sort of plateauing for a while.
Yeah.
And as we do that, it will be about continuing to really recruit the most excellent faculty we can. This year we did such a phenomenal job with some of the people we brought in.
Totally.
So I want to keep making sure we're getting that kind of faculty and just raising the bar across the school as much as we can there. Working on our facilities, getting those as good as we can. I mean, we're not going to be about the amenities. That's never really what NSA will be, but we can continue doing things like fixing up rooms like this. And so getting the facilities where we want to, and then also I'm really working in the background on getting our financial position to be as strong as we can. Mm-hmm. We added a financial advisory board this last year. Mm-hmm. I've been working on the side on an MBA that I'm almost done with. So I'm just trying to get more.
All right. Nice.
Well, he has the weirdest collection of degrees. Bar none.
Yeah. It's a little bit of an addiction, but I promise I'll stop.
I slipped this one in because I'm pretty sure that we had said that's it. But then an MBA.
Point is, I'm trying to take our financial situation really seriously and to make sure. I see a lot of institutional compromise is driven by money, and I want to get us in as strong a position as possible so we can be principled and clear to really stay on focus. So I think what you'll see, I really hope that nobody sees an actual drift from the vision. I think that we are still really authentically what we've been all along. Yeah. I just want to do it better and better. We'll probably get, I think, clearer and sharper about what that means over the upcoming years. And I think one of the things I think you'll also see is NSA just getting more and more competitive. Mm-hmm. I think the rigor just keeps going up, keeps getting better and better, and I hope to continue to improve that.
Well, wonderful.
And to close, usually we ask the professors about their hobbies. So together,
I'm glad
what do
that
you
we
like?
We weren't going to sing the doxology together.
We can do that if you would like.
You start.
Sorry.
Besides Bible trivia, which before we started filming, they were just talking about Bible trivia, which is great. As you do. What do you guys enjoy doing together?
Okay, so things we enjoy doing together. Well, we do. It's not so much a hobby, but because it's just my work. But we travel a lot together, and that's true. I do a lot of travel to represent the school. And one of the best gifts that the board has given me is that when I go, I can take Becca with me wherever. So we spend a lot of time just traveling together. That's been a lot of fun, actually, as long as if she's with me. I think our kids are probably another big part of our life together. So
we dabble in kids. Parenting. Well,
we've got kids that are now we've got kids spread out all over. So the kids that are here, you know, Our Sunday lunch is always kind of like a centerpiece, but now we're traveling to go see kids all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then the other big piece is probably our house. We have this old house that was built in 1890 that we are slowly working on. So if we're not on the road or hang out with our kids, then we're
Or doing an MBA.
Then we're plinking away at the house. I'm slowly trying to build kitchen cabinets and other different things in the house. Her major fixation right now is gardening. And so
fixation, but am I doing it? Not so much, but I like to think.
What she does is she reads gardening books while we are on planes.
It's so frustrating because that's the time that I have to read. So I'm like reading and then you get all inspired. You're sitting on a plane. There's nothing you can do about it. And so, yeah, I would love to get, it's mostly stuff at the house and design. I feel like doing this and.
Yeah. Yeah. She does. She's launched her own design business. And so I think that you can see it here. The fabric on the walls, she designed that and had that produce. It's fabric that's on the walls. She wallpapered with fabric that she designed and had made.
I had
somewhere.
It woven, especially with the NSA colors. And I just, I like it. I feel like
And the ceiling tiles, those are another fabric that she produced that represent the various halls at NSA.
Well, so that was just because the ceiling was so terrible. Like, it was so bad. And it was a drop ceiling. And there was nothing to be done about it. And there were huge holes. Nothing is square. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible long time that I was up there.
It felt kind of like an insane asylum before we redid it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So anyway, we covered it with fabric in an attempt to make it look like, although weird, at least it was on purpose.
There we go.
But she does, she's got a design business now and she does kitchen towels and different things like that. They're on that. And then also her podcast, that's probably another big podcast and writing.
Plug your podcast.
Yeah. My podcast.
Yeah, with all the listeners we have to send your way.
That's true. It's the world's most unprofessional podcast. Yeah, wonderful. What have you?
Nice.
They are. So actually, the What Have You podcast started as an NSA podcast.
Did it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was an NSA podcast. And I remember the previous marketing guy, he had a special microphone, everything that he bought for them, like highly professional. Mm-hmm. They would never remember to take it. And they just would set their iPhone on the dash of the car, leaving the car engine running so you can hear that rumbling over. It's like the most
windshield wipers on,
unprofessional.
Baby in the back seat.
Yeah,
raining maybe.
Yeah,
So we will go the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
Hyper professional.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. This has been great. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.